To order, it's February 13th, and the time is 8:20, starting a little late because of technical problems.
Your microphone, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. For the roll, we have Representative Sharice Millett, Representative Lynn Gaddis, Representative Shelley Hughes, Representative Jonathan Grice Thompson, and Representative Doug Isaacson, and myself, Representative Keller. I'm the vice chair, and I'm sitting in temporarily here. The chair is on his way, so Representative Bob Lynn. So we have before us today two things. One is HB 284. That's the one we're going to start with. That's my bill. And then we're going to go to HB 199. So for starters, I will present the bill from here, partly because we have expert help with HB 284 and my staff, and I'll have them come up in a bit, you know, and make a more methodical presentation of the bill. But I have some opening comments. For the record, as sponsor, I am Wes Keller, District 7, northwest of Scylla in the Susitna River. HB 284, what it does is it calls for a specific balanced budget amendment, and it uses what is called the Compact for America. So it's using the compact process, and it's proposing an amendment to the Constitution under the Article 5 process. Article 5 is cropping up more and more. It's somewhat of a renewal of some good information. It's a copy of it back there in the corner. If you want to read it at your leisure, feel free. One thing before we start, this is a bit of a different bill, and so I'm going to start a little different in that I'm going to appeal to you that as you listen to it unfold, and if you begin to feel a hope surge in you and you're excited about it, I just really ask for your consideration on those green slips, co-sponsor. Get as many as we can on this. It's certainly something that has increased my hope and excitement. First, I want to say a little bit about the amendment process in general, Article 5. The United States of America definitely gets credit for inventing the amendment process. It was a vogue thing then to begin to write constitutions down, you know, and it was all over the world at that time. And but our first 13 colonies, only five of them had an amendment process built into their constitutions. You know, they wrote down the Constitution, but only half of them had that. And that evolved, I guess, into the setting where we ended up in the U.S. Constitution. And the U.S. Constitution, it started out with that only Congress had the power to make amendments to the Constitution. And, only Congress had the power. But there was an early version of that. And then later on, it was amended to include in the states, give the states. It's a monument. Article 5 is a monument to two things. One is the sovereignty of we the people. The other is the sovereignty of the states. And it's a statement. It's saying, hey, we've got this body of law that is overriding law of we the people, and we can make amendments. But they set a real high bar in order to get there, but they built a process in to change it. And so this is an important amendment to consider. The our Constitution, U.S. Constitution, has only been amended 27 times, you all know. And every one of those was a process that went through with Congress. But this compact is using focusing on the other way a amendment can be ratified or proposed and ratified, and that is through the states. We have today, frankly, I got to start out. I am not a constitutional lawyer. I'm not a compact lawyer. You know, you could get me twisted around your little finger in any debate on compacts, no problem at all. And I'm not even a budget expert. But we brought Nick Dranius here. He's going to be come up, and he's going to present the bill. And he is an expert. He's been working on this for a long time. He really caught my enthusiasm, and I'm really eager to have him. A little later on here, I'm going to have him and Ernest work together to give a real methodical overview of the bill, section by section, so you can evaluate what's going on. I'm going to take a little at ease here. Representative Lynn, just to put back on the record, Representative Lynn has joined us. I got to tell you, when we was talking about the budget, the debt, I should say. When we, it's amazing. It's got us all angry. It's frustrated. You know, we sit here and, and it looks like, you know, what's being done to us. You know, we feel like there's just nothing we can do. And for the first time, I think that there is something, and I think that HB 284 represents that. In the time I began getting my talk points together and thinking about this bill, I was watching the different reports, you know, and you see one day and it says $17 trillion in debt. And then a couple days later, you know, a week later, whatever, $17.1 trillion in debt. And now the most recent one I saw was $17.4 trillion in debt. Well, one-tenth of a trillion is $100 billion. You know, and this has just happened in the time frame that I have begun to really focus on the talk points of this bill. So it's a big number. And what's happening is our kids are being born mortgaged. And what the money that is being borrowed on our kids and our grandkids is money that we're spending right now. And it's just, it's an immoral situation. We've got to do something to stop this. We've known this. I'm telling you things that we already know. We've known this, but here's a way we can go. I got want to read one of the quote. November 26, 1798, Thomas Jefferson, 11 years after the Constitution was written. This is a direct quote in a letter that he wrote to a friend of his. "I wish it were possible to obtain a single amendment to our Constitution. I would be willing to depend on that alone for the reduction of the administration of our government to the genuine principles of its Constitution. I mean an additional article taking from the federal government the power of borrowing." It's an incredible quote. You know, that was only 11 years after the Constitution was written. And here we are, you know, years later, and we're, you know, realizing that Article 5 may be the answer for us to bring us back in line. So, anyway, I think what we'll do at this point is we'll go to Nick, who's going to come up here, and he's going to present the bill for us. I did claim jurisdiction on the first slide, and he graciously let me do that. And the reason that I did is I drew it for one thing, but I need a visual in order to sort this thing out. You know, the Article 5 has two ways to propose an amendment, and it has two ways to ratify. And you got to read it a bunch of times before it begins to sort out, you know. And then we've got all this noise on the news, and I don't mean that derogatorily, of the different groups that are interested in Article 5. So, Ernest, will you throw that slide up, can you? Is it up? No. And Nick, you can come on up. Nick is here, by the way, from Phoenix, and he's with the Goldwater Institute. And for in Phoenix, they don't have snow, I guess, this time of year. But he tells me he has some experience with the Northland, and I will turn it over to Nick in just a little bit. This is what I wanted to show you. For me, the important things to realize when you're talking Article 5 is that there's two triggers, and one is a two-thirds trigger. And you'll see that vertical line there. In order to propose an amendment, that is a amendment to the Constitution, you have to have a two-thirds vote states. You know, two-thirds of the states have to agree. And a lot of people are working to get that amendment convention together. You know, and one of them is, you know, Mount Vernon Assembly. You heard that. I was fortunate enough to have been there. You've heard of the Convention of States, COS. That's Representative Wilson's bill. You know, we've heard about that. We have the Reagan Project. I put that one up there. Reagan Project is an interesting one. I don't know much about it, except that, interesting for us, there's two people I know that are promoting it. One is Fritz Pettyjohn, and another one is Robin Taylor. So names you might remember, but they're working on that. And then we have, there's BB4 USA org, but all this you're hearing from Mark Levin and Glenn Beck and everything. It's all pointed at this one thing, getting into that amendment convention. But in order for something to become actually an amendment to the Constitution, there's another trigger, and that's the three-quarters of the states, and there's two ways that can be identified there. But the one I want you to look at and where we're at is down there at the bottom, compactofamerica.org. That's the Goldwater Institute is coordinating that in several states, and that avoids the need for a amendment convention with two-thirds of the states showing up in person. And what they've done is they've built a structure in this bill that is before you that bypasses that. So if we can get a couple states together here and begin this out, then when we get to three-fourths of the states, then it becomes a amendment to our U.S. Constitution. That's a very rough, I'm not trying to get into details. I just want you to see that everything over there on the left, we're at the beginning stages. We got a long ways to go. If you put a timeline on this thing and you look over to the three-quarter trigger, depending on the approach that's being taken, we're talking maybe 10 years in the future before something can be done. And that's one of the novel things about HB 284. This could be done in 1 year. It's very, very precise, and you'll hear that as you go. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Nick. If you would, identify yourself, introduce yourself for the record so it's on the record and have your name, and I'll just let you go over it. And I'll let you and Ernest decide. At some point, I want you to go over the bill section by section, and I want to put on the record for the chair, who I'm going to hand the gavel here to in just a bit, I'm not requesting that this bill move today. It's up to it's completely the will of the committee. We have to learn and we have to process. But I'd also like to point out that it is in the process of the hearings that will be coming to judiciary. And as chair of judiciary, I promise it'll get a fair, honest hearing on every detail. So today it's concept mostly, but I still would like to go through the process of you going through section by section eventually. So with that, introduce yourself for the record, and I'm going to just pass
the
gavel.
Okay.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning. It's a great pleasure to hear Chairman Lynn, members of this committee. You have a beautiful town.
Could you move the mic a little closer, or somebody turn up the volume, or turn on my ears?
How's this work? Is this good? All right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Nick Dranius. I'm the Director of Constitutional Government at the Goldwater Institute. Don't hold this against me. I'm a 16-year attorney. 8 years of that has been focused on constitutional law. I have one U.S. Supreme Court win under my belt, and I've been focusing on constitutional scholarship with the Goldwater Institute for the past nearly 6 years. The compact approach to Article 5, to amending the Constitution with a balanced budget amendment, is something we've only developed in the past 2 years with the assistance of Senior Judge Harold DeMoss of the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And just before I get into the meat of this presentation, I wanted to just introduce into the record some of the written testimony that accompanies this, so that you can have full comfort that this has been fully vetted and indeed is constitutional and consistent with history. In your packet is a written testimony from Ilya Shapiro, the lead constitutional scholar of the Cato Institute, vouching for the constitutionality of this bill. There is also Dr. Byron Schlomach, who's a PhD economist at the Goldwater Institute, and he vouches for its economic sound policy. Dr. Sven Larson of the Wyoming Liberty Institute, also an economist, PhD, an unusual fellow in that he is a Keynesian man on the center right, but he, even from a Keynesian perspective, vouches for the sound fiscal policy of this bill. The gentleman, Dr. Kevin Gutzman, professional historian, tenured professor, also a New York Times bestseller, vouches for this being consistent with the history of the Constitution in Article 5. And then finally, Chip DeMoss, also known as Harold DeMoss III, Judge DeMoss's son, CEO of Compact for America, introduces his father's analysis of the compact pushed Article 5, which follows as being fully constitutional and consistent with what the founders intended. So with that introduced, you will also see a couple of one-page documents that will help you understand the bill. One is a sectional analysis that's very, very short, and the other is a brief one-page analysis of how the compact works in one page.
I have a personal life of Barry Goldwater. I got to meet him a couple times, and he actually sent me a pair of his pilot wings, and I've got them with a letter to me. So personal years.
Are you stating a conflict of interest?
It's difficult to have a conflict of interest if somebody's already passed away.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're very proud to carry Senator Goldwater's name. One of the great things about Senator Goldwater is that he left behind a son, Barry Goldwater Jr., who sits on our board and is quite active. The other thing that I think is important to emphasize about Senator Barry Goldwater is he did find principled compromises with not only the center-right, but the center-left. He was an unusual politician that could maintain his principle and look for the common ground. And so one of the things I want to emphasize on this bill, although I'm obviously here on behalf of the Goldwater Institute, that this bill is meant to be nonpartisan. It's meant to be bipartisan. It's meant to fix the debt and do so in a serious, non-wild goose chase way. We have a three-year time horizon to getting this done. I mean literally getting this done. And so we will I'll walk you through this bill really quickly, but if you want to know why it's 3 years, here's why it's 3 years. Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, this is our national debt trajectory today. This is an unsustainable debt. It is headed to infinity and beyond. It is simply absurd that we trust this bankrupt federal government with control, unilateral control, over setting its own credit limit without limit. Now, this is a nominal figure, so some folks might say that this doesn't give you the full context. Maybe if you adjust it for inflation or you look at it in terms of percentage of GDP, that this problem would go away. Sadly, no. If you look at the gross federal debt as a percentage of the gross domestic product, everything we produce in a year, we're at over 107% of gross domestic product today. The last time we were in this place was during the height of World War II, when we had a true tyrant in the world that could have taken Western civilization down, actually a couple of them. We are not in that same position, yet we are borrowing at the same level. Not only that, but unlike in the 1950s, when we grew our way out of that debt, we will not be the only economy standing. And we will not have an unmortgaged future, because the debt is actually just the tip of the iceberg of what we have mortgaged on future generations. There are estimates saying unfunded entitlement programs are between $100 to $220 trillion in the red. So unlike in the 1950s, not only are we not the only economy standing, not only is it unlikely we can grow our way out of the magnitude of this kind of debt alone, but we've mortgaged the future in a way that is simply calamitous. 5-6 years ago, when Greece was in this same position as a percentage of GDP, people panicked. They're still panicking. We should be a lot more concerned, because it is not getting better. Now, you may have heard that last year's deficit was $1.1 trillion. This year, it's a mere $650 billion. Any sort of debt on this magnitude is unsustainable. It is absurd. It is ridiculous. Look at the tiny little closing of the deficit, but look at the drop in the overall debt. It continues. We're now nearly at $18 trillion. Just yesterday, the latest maneuver in Washington was to completely suspend the federal debt limit. Suspend it, mind you. This is not just lifting the debt limit. Until mid-March, there will be no debt limit yet again, just like we had no debt limit between October and February 8th in the federal government. Washington is not learning from its behavior. It is not looking out around the world and seeing what this has done to devastate the economies in Europe and in Argentina and in many other third world countries. Now, maybe the folks in the powers that be in Washington think we're just going to default. Maybe that's the end game. Well, that can't be the end game if we're responsible and if we care about future generations, because Argentina has found it is not a successful policy choice. Just a couple of years ago, their Air Force One was nearly seized by a hedge fund creditor because of their default on the debt nearly 13 years ago. Now, they litigated over that for a couple of years and eventually got the Air Force One released to them. But that's just one instance of what has happened to Argentina. You may be aware of a federal lawsuit that's still pending in New York, where hedge funds are trying to get access to some of the pension assets that were maintained in the jurisdiction of the United States because of the default on their debt. The other thing that people don't realize about Argentina when they defaulted is they scotched a lot of trade agreements. They can't do business anywhere near like they used to do business with the world, and in a world of interconnected economies, that is absolutely devastating. And then lastly, in just 3 years after the debt was defaulted on in Argentina, after Argentina could no longer borrow abroad, what did it do? It nationalized everyone's 401ks. It took all of the good assets that people had saved up over the course of their working lives and replaced them with worthless government bonds, just so that they had a captured borrowing base. That is our future if we don't stop the bleeding now. We have a three-year time horizon because we do not have 3 or 5 or 10 more years to fix this problem. We have to stop it now, otherwise we are headed the same road as Argentina. And if you think Argentina is all that different, keep in mind in the 1940s they were wealthier than we were on a per capita basis. And we know this, no matter who's in charge in Washington, Washington never fixes the problem. It doesn't matter whether it's Republicans, Democrats, even with Ross Perot running around screaming his head off, it didn't change a thing structurally. The reason is quite simple. If you give the debtor control over his own credit limit, you should not expect that the debtor would do anything other than what we saw in those initial charts. It's the concentration of unlimited power to borrow in one hand that is being abused. How could it be any other way? And it's more than that. This is a structural problem of democracy. It's the reason why 49 states limit debt in their own constitutions or in their own statutes or in their own case law. Good people on the left and the right over 100 years ago came together around a consensus recognizing that unlimited debt in the hands of an elected class is not restrictable. It's not containable. And here's why. You can get elected giving current constituents the benefits of your spending while shifting the costs to non-voting future generations when you're safely out of office. There is no inherent check in the democratic process that can adequately protect those non-voting future generations from being saddled with the burden of our policy choices today. So whether you look at this from the perspective of someone on the center right and you worry about the growth of government, or you look at this from the perspective of someone on the center left and you just think in terms of democracy and having the will of the people truly be expressed in the instrumentalities and organs of government, we have a silent supermajority that is being denied its future, and that is our kids and their kids. Without a fundamental law that limits the use of debt, this will continue and it will destroy our future. That's why 49 states have converged on this solution. So what do we need? We need a balanced budget amendment for the federal government that learns from the states and strikes at the root of the problem. We need one that divides power, that takes the hand, takes away from the hands of the debtor the power to set his own credit limit. I mean, think of the absurdity of what we see going on in the federal government. Many states, maybe Alaska, I don't want to prejudge, but most states have school boards that when they want to issue bonds, they have to have a referendum of the people in their district. We don't even trust school boards with the degree of debt authority that we trust the federal government with. What we need is to learn from what the states have done at the state and local level and apply it to the federal government. Here's how. First of all, we cannot define a balanced budget in terms of budgets. Budgets are baked, cooked, projected, made up. If you define a balanced budget in terms of budgets, you are inviting gaming. There's only one way to have a clean, clear, ungameable definition of a balanced budget, and that is to limit spending the money that you've got. To have it be cash flow based at all points in time, period, end of story. Now, you're probably going to say, how does that work? You know, tax flow comes in, comes out, there's volatility in receipts, you have commitments to make spending. How do you have it be strictly cash flow based? Well, it turns out that you can only do this if you have a revolving line of credit. In other words, there is a role for debt in a proper balanced budget amendment that is not gainable. And the role of debt, properly, responsibly, is to provide a line of credit to handle the volatility in tax receipts so that you can make good on your spending commitments. So keep in mind, a balanced budget amendment is not an anti-debt measure. It's a responsible use of debt measure. And it's a measure aimed at ending the gamesmanship and the opaque and non-transparent approach that Washington takes to its debt time and time again, waiting to the midnight hour to spring upon us a new $500-600 billion commitment to borrow. Now, we can't just have an inflexible line of credit. Why? Because there could be a war. There could be a Katrina. But if you need flexibility in this initial line of credit, You can't let Congress control that flexibility. You're not learning from the very disasters we see unfolding us in Washington right now, where you keep all of the control over debt in the hands of the debtor. Now, if you want that flexibility, you have to ensure that the flexibility comes from outside of Washington, that it divides power, that it does not give the debtor the power to set his own credit limit. So what this balanced budget amendment does is it says if there's a war, if there's a crisis, if there's a legitimate reason to borrow beyond this fixed initial revolving line of credit, you have to make a proposal to the states. State legislatures, a majority of them in a referendum, would have to approve that increase. These legislatures are closer to the people. The people for the past 40 years in sustained polling say that they want a limit on debt. They want responsible use of debt. Structurally, having a referendum of the states on any increase in the debt will prevent the debtor from setting his own credit limit. It will give a bigger voice and more relevancy to the people who are more concerned about their children than our elected class in Washington.
Question.
Mr. Chairman.
In the case of a war, national emergency, Katrina times 10 or something, is there time to get a referendum of all the states? Something just happened.
Yep.
You have to respond. Matter of self-defense. Yep.
Mr. Chairman, representative of the committee, there's a lot of flexibility built into this. For example, Congress could send out a measure in advance of any crisis and say this is a debt crisis borrowing authorization measure. In the event we hit these criteria, we will get an additional $10 trillion. And then the states would have the opportunity long in advance of any crisis to approve or disapprove that sort of possible contingency borrowing. Now, even if it were so unplannable that Congress couldn't even react in that way, even though this is a three-year process and presumably once we get close to the end game, Congress will be thinking these things. But even if, let's just say that Congress didn't have the opportunity. The reality is bond markets do not instantaneously give Congress credit even right now. It takes about a month for any new bond issuance to arise, even when Congress has complete control over its debt limit. So really the question is, can states mobilize themselves quickly enough in a 9/11 times 10 emergency to provide more debt? Well, I think they can certainly mobilize within 30 days, and if it were a problem to mobilize within 30 days, I doubt that bond markets would be functioning well enough to handle the problem anyhow. So the bottom line is, yes, this is adequate flexibility for handling a war situation, and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you should keep in mind there are about 20 balanced budget amendment proposals that Congress has drafted. The problem with those is they have a blanket exception for a crisis defined by who? By Congress. And we've been in a war now declared sort of since 2001. Under all of the balanced budget amendment proposals Congress has ever proposed, there would be no limit on debt at all as long as that original Patriot Act declaration remained outstanding. And so in the end, we have to recognize the root cause of debt problems is the creditor setting his own credit limit. We need to have a process that doesn't allow the debtor to decide when he has enough borrowing. We need to have an outside intervention from the states. I have confidence that states like Alaska will react responsibly when this bill starts getting close to the finish line. It will create emergency ways of organizing to respond to these requests. We'll have contingency plans in place, such as perhaps legislators who travel to Washington to keep an eye on things and be ready to react. So there's a number of other things that you can imagine emerging to ensure that we have adequate flexibility.
That's pretty responsible. I don't know about the other 49.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have great hope this is an issue moving now in Georgia, Arkansas, Arizona. We're looking at Louisiana, Ohio. We want to keep it small this session so that the founding member states have control over the initial product. But the bottom line is we have tremendous interest from a number of a wide diversity of states. And in the end, the states, whether they're inherently good or not, they're closer to the people. The polling shows the American people for the past 40 years at supermajority levels, left, right, and center, want a limit on debt. The states are going to be more likely to respond to that for good or bad reasons than Washington ever will be. And with that said,
just briefly, Mr. Vice Chair,
it takes what percentage of states to approve an expansion? That'd be a good time to put that on the record.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Keller, members of the committee, it would be only a simple majority, and that is to maximize the possibility of flexibility, but still having a significant debate. Now, that means that you're not going to always limit debt. Not even when it should be limited. But the point is, you are finally taking the debate out of Washington. You're putting the debate in state capitals that are closer to the people, where you have a greater voice as legislators, where the people have a greater voice as people, and the special interests are not as able to dominate it like they can from K Street. Structurally, this would produce better and more responsible debt policy over the long run, and it will also be flexible enough to deal with any crisis.
I wanted to ask you, if I may. Does this legislation call for, do all the states have to agree to what was in here, word by word by word, punctuation included, or can anything, any flexibility at all between our state and one of the other states?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Keller, members of the committee, right now you are doing the historic job of deliberating over this initial version of the bill. There are good solid reasons for the language as it is, but obviously the amendment process can take place. The chief goal that the Goldwater Institute would ask you to help us with is that if you do make changes, communicate them to us so we can communicate them to other states, or even better, let me introduce all of you to the co-sponsors and prime sponsors in all the other states so that this is coordinated and done. The fortunate thing is with things like Skype, email, and telephones that, unlike in 200 years ago, would have made this impossible, today we can successfully coordinate those changes. But once the compact is formed, it is going to have to be identical, and it will, in fact, need to be adopted identically by all other states that join it, unless unanimously everyone agrees to those changes. Now, mind you, with the compact that we're designing, one of the first things it does, as soon as you have two states in it, is it forms a commission that has the job of handling logistics, so it's not just Nick at the Goldwater Institute anymore. That commission, naturally, if it saw a need to adjust the terms of the compact, would be a natural point of leverage to coordinating further tweaks as the process continued. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Alaska is probably a member of 20 or more compacts right now. There are over 200 in existence. Every year, one of these compacts is tweaked, even though they all have to be unanimous, even though they all have to be identical. It is standard practice to revise and return to and update compacts. You see it in the insurance business. You see it when it comes to extradition of prisoners. There are a variety of compacts that are constantly being tweaked and worked on. What's great about using a compact for Article 5 is at least you have a permanent structure in place to work from. See, without a compact, you just have a stack of paper. And that stack of paper doesn't have a voice, and it doesn't have an institution to coordinate anything that might have to arise from it. But a compact creates that institution. It creates a point of structure. And it's, even though identicality is required, it's not impossible. It happens all the time with the dozens and dozens of compacts that are out there right now. Mr. Chairman, I hope I answered the question.
Yes, you have. And we're going to go to Representative Hughes. Kind of pace yourself if you can, because we do have another bill, maybe contentious bill, I don't know, we have to get to before we're out of here. So if we can get done somewhere between now and 9:30, something like that, it'd be good for us and good for whatever we do with the bill. Reverend Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Nick. I believe that the situation with the federal debt is of concern, and it resonates with many people. Just as follow-up to the chair's question, if a tweak were needed, does that have to come back to each state legislature if as we go? And then also, we can't bind future legislatures, so could you talk a little bit about that? And I understand that there's actually a clock that starts ticking that the whole process, I believe, if I read correctly, was 7 years, that even though your goal is sooner than that. Could you please talk about that and how that tweaking would work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hughes, members of the committee, those are fantastic questions. In the packet of materials that I believe would be made available to you electronically or already has is expert answers to frequently asked questions, which include those questions, and not just answered by me, but answered by Judge DeMoss of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, Ilya Shapiro, and others. So the first question I'd like to address is the question of entrenchment, or the possibility of a compact locking down not only the legislature that adopts it, but future legislatures. It turns out that an exception to the rule against entrenchment is the contract. Under the United States Constitution's Contracts Clause, states are barred from impairing contracts that they form.
or that others form within their state. And as a result, when a legislature creates a contract, and a compact is a type of contract, it does indeed bind that state. Even it binds it as to future legislative bodies. And in fact, if you look at the typical compacts that exist, the 200 or so that exist, they very typically are entrenched. To take one popular common example, the Colorado River Compact has a termination clause that says that nobody can extract themselves from the Colorado River Compact without the unanimous consent of all members of that compact. Now, obviously, that has the effect of entrenching the decision of the legislature that adopted it in 1926. So the reality is that entrenchment is allowed with respect to compacts. Now, there is a constitutional limit on the degree of entrenchment that will be tolerated in a compact or any contract, and that is if you're giving away too much of your sovereign power, at some point courts will say, hey, that's going too far. So as a prudent measure in the compact, we include a sunset clause that ensures the compact terminates, becomes null and void 7 years after it's first enacted by the first state. 7 years is a number we borrow from the typical sunset provision of a ratification referral from Congress, which has been used, I think, for the last three amendments. And so it seems to be a fair and adopt and standard a way of saying that now the deliberation process should have ended if it were ever to be properly finished. So this compact will sunset in 7 years. Since it only entrenches once 38 states join it, it's not entrenched prior to that, you can withdraw freely. And since it will sunset in 7 years, we don't believe that there's any possibility that would violate the outer edge or boundaries of the exception from the rule against entrenchment. In terms of the tweak question, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we've already done a number of tweaks with the engagement of Representative Keller, representatives in Georgia, Arizona, and Arkansas. We've done that prior to introduction and even after introduction in Georgia. It has been successfully coordinated. It is basically a process of emailing and making sure. And one of the great things is I can assure you, Mr. Chairman, members of this committee, there are no egos in this. There is no territory in this. Everyone, your brothers and sisters in the other states, are looking at this as a way of saving our kids and their kids. And so if you have a good, solid reason and, you know, a debatable policy point to make and doing a tweak, and if it's necessary, I have no doubt that it will get done. The trick, of course, is things move at certain speeds, so we need to be in the loop and we need to make sure it happens. Worst-case scenario, remember, all we need is two states to adopt this compact in an identical form. So let's say that a couple of states get something passed, but they're not sufficiently identical. As long as we get two states involved and you have the commission formed, that commission, I think, would naturally reach out to the other states and see what needed to be done to bring them on board with further tweaks after that.
Follow up?
I guess then, so say two states approve, both pass it, and then the following year you have more states jumping on board, but they're not passing, what they pass is a little bit different. Does it have to come back to those two states, and the state legislatures would then have to approve those changes? That was my question.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hughes, absolutely, it would have to happen that way. That's why we don't want to encourage unnecessary tweaks. But the point is, if you look at, I'm sure Alaska is probably a member of an insurance product compact. It's a popular compact. That compact is tweaked every year, as far as I can tell, and it is done unanimously eventually. I mean, it doesn't happen all in one session necessarily, but the point is, when you have a structure in place with a commission that organizes logistics, it's fairly typical that people can work out these things. And in contrast to without a compact, then, you know, a lot of these applications under Article 5 become ancient history, and they never go anywhere, and there's no one to carry it forward to the next stage. So the critical point about the compact is you're creating a live institution. And it maintains the policy push even when the winds of popular opinion may not be there for you. I don't want to go too far off the PowerPoint. I know we're short on time, but I was a big fan of Ronald Reagan. I was a strange kid in high school. I was in Americans for...
Where are you from originally?
From Chicago, the city. So he was like one of me. But nevertheless, Reagan and Friedman, Milton Friedman, started a balanced budget amendment effort in 1976. Almost 40 years later, they're still not, the original effort is still scattered It's not even at the most optimistic numbers beyond 20 applications. It's nowhere near done, and it's because over those 40 years, interest in the issue has waxed and waned. It has always just been a stack of paper, and so institutionally, there's never been a commitment to it. The thing about Representative Keller's bill is it creates an institutional commitment to persist and get the job done. And frankly, the sunset provision of 7 years focuses the mind. People realize that they've got to do it now or never. And I think that the other thing that focuses the mind is the debt. We have a problem that is infinitely bigger than what was faced in the 1970s and 80s.
But I know we're in the forefront, that's Alaska, but what other state, who's closest to us in this, and when might they act, and where are they in the process of following us?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you're going to have maybe a little catch-up to do. Georgia passed this on a voice vote out of a rather extensive Judiciary Committee last week, and it would have been on the floor this week if it weren't for the snow and ice.
Basically, Georgia is coming along.
Georgia's coming along. Also, Arizona just passed it out of the Federalism and Fiscal Committee on Tuesday, a 5-3 vote. It's waiting in the rules. Next step is the floor. Arkansas is a very unique place. They have a fiscal limit. They have to get a two-thirds procedural vote to move it forward. But the governor, a Democrat, by the way, is very, very interested, has met with our prime sponsor at least twice. Arkansas is an interesting place, of course, because President Clinton came from Arkansas. And Georgia is an interesting place because that's where Speaker Gingrich came from. And the last time the federal government had a blip of fiscal responsibility was those two people coming together. But it was just a blip, by the way, and that's because of the structural problem. But the bottom line is there are a number of states. There are three other states that are moving forward, and moving forward very significantly. Alaska, the benefit of being the first state with this is you get to select the chairman of the convention that is organized within this compact. So there's a significance to being first. I personally think, and I don't say this everywhere I go, but I personally think that having Alaska be the first state would be really good from an independence, impartiality point of view. Alaska is a little bit remote from the rest of the country, and so there wouldn't be the natural jealousies that might arise if, say, I don't know, a Texas or a Georgia became the chair of the convention. I think Alaska has a unique position to have a more abstract, more principled approach to this, but that's not coming from Alaska, so maybe you guys would disagree with me, but...
Well, a lot of these folks think we're an independent country up here.
Well, I think that it gives a perspective to the process that is not going to be so short-sighted.
Please continue. I was going to ask the Vice Chair, how many do we have other folks online to testify or in the audience?
Mr. Chair, there's one person that is online, Don Brand, and I believe that's it.
I'm trying to get...
And I would say on that, as sponsor, that where this bill is moving into Judiciary after this, I promise that we will, hear every word that is to be said out there. So if we don't get, if time crunch gets bad enough here that we don't get to Don, he's local, and I will promise that he'll be heard. So.
And as you may know, Reverend Keller is also chair of the Judiciary Committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm aware of that. We're honored to have him as our sponsor for a variety of reasons.
Thank you. Please continue.
Members of the committee, really quickly, let me just go through the balance of this balanced budget amendment. One of the things that we've built into it is a no more game of chicken provision. You may have noticed that in Washington, they wait to the midnight hour. Everybody says the end of the world is going to come, and then they lift the debt limit. And usually what starts the whole debate is the president threatening to impound, veterans' benefits or something like that.
Which he's done, by the way.
Which he has done. What the balanced budget amendment does that we've designed is make sure that cannot happen, because it requires the president to start identifying impoundments at 98% of the debt limit, which at current burn rates means about 6 months before hitting the debt limit. And so the president, 6 months before hitting the debt limit, is going to have to lay on the table what he proposes to impound. Congress will have, with simple majorities, an opportunity within 30 days to override those proposed impoundments. And the point is, you will have that discussion now clarified clear, and, you know, obviously the discussion would continue beyond the impoundment phase because we're borrowing 45 cents of every dollar, so if you're going to impound, that's going to be a lot of bloodletting in the budget. But the point is, at least 6 months prior to hitting the debt limit, you will have had a very clarifying moment where everybody puts their cards on the table, everyone knows the stakes that are involved with enforcing the debt limit, and if there's going to be a need for more debt or a need for more revenues or a need for more spending cuts, you will have plenty of time to make those cases, either internally in Congress or externally to the states. So this is called the anti-game of chicken provision. It's rather a simple fix, but notably not in Washington. The other thing that we've done is we've added a tax limit, but it's a modified tax limit because if we go too far limiting the possibility of raising taxes to close the deficit, we lose some of our friends on the center left. And we need our friends on the center left because you can't get anything done without 38 states. And there are some fairly blue states in those 38 states. So we can't go whole hog as much as we'd like to on the far right to just say, no more taxes. And we shouldn't, because debt is taxes. Let's not kid ourselves. If we're paying the debt back, it's coming out of taxes. And if we're borrowing more than we can possibly grow our way out of, then we're going to be raising taxes. So a debt limit is a tax limit. The real question is, do we sacrifice current generations to future generations or future generations to current generations? We've designed a tax limit that does neither, which I think is the right choice. What we've done is we've said, if you want to raise taxes after this is in place, you have to get two-thirds of each house, the whole number, not a quorum, for any new tax or any increase in an existing tax, but with three exceptions. You can do simple majority approval of a replacement of the income tax with a end-user sales tax, not a VAT. So wholesaling replacing the entire income tax with a what's sometimes called a fair tax, you can do that with simple majorities even if you raise revenue. You can close all the credits, deductions, exemptions in the existing taxes. That can be done with simple majorities as well. You could raise tariffs or fees. That could be done with simple majorities. So you have these three exceptions that only require simple majorities, which is the same as it is right now, so it doesn't make things worse. But what it does is it channels the drive for any new revenue to places where special interest pushback would be the strongest, and where a truly legitimate need for more revenue probably would be the only thing that could overcome that special interest pushback. And I'm sure that you may have had experience trying to broaden the sales tax base or trying to close credits or deductions. You know that special interest pushback is probably nearly as strong as a two-thirds vote requirement. So this is a rather significant limit on taxes, but at the same time, it does allow for truly necessary revenues. We think this is a principled compromise. We think that with our polling data showing that even Democrats prefer spending cuts first over tax increases, that this is a plausible limit that could get its way through 38, maybe even 39 states under current conditions. So that's the BDA. Now, as you ponder the BDA, ask yourself, how likely is it that Congress would ever propose something like this itself? It is very unlikely. Respectfully to our friends in Congress, which is why, as Representative Keller points out, we have the state-originated amendment process in Article 5. The founders anticipated that someday we might need amendments that Congress has a conflict of interest proposing themselves. That's where the states come in. Really quickly, because we're short on time, I want to show you the mechanics of the compact and why this is a quicker, easier, more certain, and safer way to accomplish a state-originated amendment. To fully appreciate the compact, we need to first go and take a time machine back, and that is to listen to the words of Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry and George Mason were true patriots. They made it possible for us to form our nation. And guess what? They hated the Constitution. They fought it tooth and nail. Patrick Henry railed for 6 hours at the Virginia Convention saying, "Don't ratify this horrible document." And a huge part of his argument was that the state origination of amendments was impossible. It was a ruse, it was a fraud, because nobody could ever get through it. It was so complicated, not even with 13 states in it. Now, what Patrick Henry said in 1788 with 13 states has even more resonance today. And I don't say this to disparage all the other Article 5 movements out there. I actually advocated them for years, since even before it was cool. The point is, though, we have to be honest, we have to be clear, we have to understand the challenge that not using a compact poses. Here's that challenge. You need at least 100 legislative acts to get it done from beginning to end. Now, mind you, there has never been a coordinated legislative process of any kind, whether you look to the Uniform Commercial Code or anything else, that has been able to do this. Now, imagine this for a constitutional amendment. Now, you say, well, honey, well, where does that come from? Well, you have 34 states pass resolutions for an application to Congress. In places like Alaska, you can't avoid gubernatorial presentment. Congress has to call. Now, legally, constitutionally, Congress is supposed to have a mandatory obligation to call a convention if that happens, but, you know, Congress never violates the Constitution, right? I mean, they always do what they're supposed to do. No, they don't. So the problem is you still need the political will in Congress to pass a resolution of simple majorities. That's the practical reality. Then the states have presumably sent somebody to the convention. That means at least some kind of quorum, at least 26 states got to pass laws sending people. Then, assuming the convention does anything, you know, you can't really count the convention doing anything, but you know, it could deadlock really easily. But assuming that the convention does something, then it has to propose an amendment to Congress, and Congress has to refer it back out. Again, Congress is supposed to do this without a matter of choice. It must do this. But again, reality says that they might not. And so you need to have political will to pass a resolution with simple majorities and make sure it happens. Then you've got to have 38 states ratify what is generated from Congress. Now, mind you, it's not just 38 state legislative acts. It's possible Congress will choose to have in-state conventions be the mode of ratification. Not every state has laid out in their own statute books yet how to do that in-state convention. So you could have another round of legislation on top of the convention to try to get this done. So this is a difficult process. And it's not that we shouldn't try it, but let's recognize how difficult this is without a compact. This is a Hail Mary pass, not just once. It's once, twice, three times, four times. Now, I'm all for Hail Mary passes if that's all we've got. But it's not all we've got. The compact approach makes this process doable. It makes it simpler. Makes it more easy. Now, mind you, it can't really be used, as we talked about tweaks, it can't really be used for political ideas that are divisive. It can't really be used for overly complex issues. It can't really be used where you don't really have a clear policy solution in mind yet. It's really only something that can work for a well-defined supermajority product that plausibly in the near future can command minimal of tweaks in 38 state support. You should know that our partner organization spent $50,000 on a poll testing the various components of the BBA in our compact. They all poll every component, even the state referendum component polls at 60% plus. That being said, compacts are not the exclusive way to go. They can only practically be used for things that do that kind of polling. Other things that require drafting, consensus building, those are all going to have to be done through the traditional route. There's no other choice. So here's what the compact does. First, you have a state compact, one piece of overarching legislation. Second, you have a single congressional resolution, one piece of overarching legislation. In the compact, you have the proposed amendment, Article 2 in your bill. In the compact, you have the commission we talked about that organizes logistics, makes it an institutional process. In the compact, you have the application required by Article 5. Now, the application uses a conditional enactment that only sends out the application to Congress once 38 states join the compact. Okay? 38 states is chosen, not 34, because if you can't get to 38, why are you bothering? As soon as that application goes live, in the congressional resolution in Title I, a preloaded call for the convention in accordance with the compact is triggered. When that call goes live in the compact, it triggers delegate appointments specified in the compact. It instructs those delegates to vote into place rules requiring an up or down vote on the amendment it contemplates. That goes live. It builds in a scope limitation that nullifies anything that might come out of the convention other than the BBA that is contemplated, satisfying that many reasonable people worry about runaway conventions. Assuming the convention actually, in this limited fashion, votes up rather than down the amendment that's contemplated, that immediately triggers, using a conditional enactment in the congressional resolution, the ratification referral that's in Section 2. As soon as that goes live based on the conditional enactment, it triggers the preloaded ratification in the compact that was already there from the beginning. That goes live. Boom. You can get done in a grand total of 38 enactments in the states, assuming minimal tweaks or none, hopefully, and one enactment in Congress, everything that would otherwise take over 100 enactments using the non-compact approach. That makes this plausible, but more importantly, it makes it campaignable, because you can know all the political players that are involved in this process as you're plotting how to get from point A to point B. You can't know that in the regular Article 5 approach without a compact. And that's one of the greatest challenges about the non-compact approach of Article 5 is you have so many different legislative sessions you have to navigate. You just cannot campaign it out based on known political quantities at all. So, I support the other version of Article 5. I do support it. But I think it's important to emphasize that not only is it a series of Hail Mary passes, in a very real sense, it's a blindfold Hail Mary pass over and over again. So, the compact, for once, finally resolves all uncertainty in the process. Everything is determined in front, and everyone knows what they're getting into. And this resolves a lot of the concerns that some folks have had on the left and the right about the Article 5 convention process. You know, without a compact, things just have to unfold, and nobody knows exactly how they're going to unfold. I don't think they unfold in a scary way, mind you. I'm more worried about them just not unfolding. But the nice thing about the compact is you have a particular product, a particular vehicle. It's like a ballot measure. You know what you're going to get. Now, it may not sell, just like ballot measures fail. It may not get to 38 states, just like ballot measures fail. Most ballot measures fail. But like a ballot measure, it's known in advance. And it has 16 safeguards built in to satisfy folks who are concerned about runaway conventions. And by the way, we have this peer review by Andy Schlafly, Phyllis Schlafly of Eagle Forum's son. Each one of these safeguards is a result of his various demands. And we got him exhausted. He doesn't support the compact. I think he's neutral. I don't know exactly. But we got to the point after 2 months of phone calls and emails where he ran out of safeguards that he wanted, and we were done. So if you're wondering why we're there, that's why.
I want to ask you, you mentioned the runaway compact. Is there anything here that would permit that you... Many of us have always been afraid of this. You get a group together to change the Constitution and it goes berserk. And you know all the issues that are out there that could be brought forth and potentially become an amendment to the Constitution. Is there a type of guarantee or anything that would not happen or stick to the subject at hand and not wander off into other areas?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
I know the answer, but I want you to put it on the record.
Yes, absolutely yes, 110% yes. There's Article 8 in your bill. Article 8 in your bill specifically nullifies anything that might happen at the convention other than what is specifically mapped out. But it goes even further. It actually binds all of the member states to not ratifying anything that might come out of the convention other than the contemplated balanced budget amendment. And because it's a compact and regarded as a binding contract that has entrenchment capabilities, so long as that compact is in place, that will lock down the member states. So there is better protection from a runaway convention than anything could ever have in reality. Now, the point I make, though, is if someone truly believes that the convention is going to be a coup d'etat and going to break out of all the safeguards and just run away, we have built so many safeguards into the compact that for that to happen, we've already lost our society. I mean, if they could get away with completely obliterating this straitjacket, why we'd have tanks in the streets long before that happened. The last thing we'd have to worry about is a runaway convention. So what we've done is we've made the possibility so remote that the possibility of having a tyranny is greater, and we won't have to worry about it.
Any comment on that from anybody? Okay, please, we will wrap it up about another 5 minutes.
I can do that, Mr. Chairman, representatives. All right. So we think it doesn't get any safer than this. And one thing I'd like to point out is, right now Congress is a standing constitutional convention. Under current case law, it only takes 2/3 of a quorum to propose amendments in Congress on any subject. And not only that, but Congress sets its own rules, and nobody has any say-so over what kind of goofy rules they might set. So the reality is, if we are not worried about Congress, despite all the destruction and all the calamity that they're meeting upon us and our kids, why are we worried about this? The great thing about the compact, the great thing about Article 5 is it brings it home to you, brings it closer to the people, decentralizes power, fixes the problem. So in the end, the best thing you can do is have a compact for a balanced budget amendment. And my last point I want to make is, there's a dirty little secret in Article 5, and that is the role of Congress. Congress does have positions of power. It's not supposed to abuse its positions of power, but it has those positions. Congress controls the call. Congress controls the ratification referral. If you don't use a compact, you got to go back to Congress not once, but twice. And you got to hope each time Congress does what it's supposed to do and doesn't table the bill or otherwise try to screw around with things. Now, Do I think Congress will just blankly say, no, we're not going to call the convention if 34 states in real time manage to pull up and say, demand, give us a convention? No. What I think is likely is that Congress will instead pass a bill that organizes the convention as a mini-Congress with a lower proposal of amendments threshold. We know that, in fact, that's what they will do because they've actually introduced bills like that twice already, once in the 1970s and once in the 1980s. So Congress's vision in response to Article 5, we know, is that if the states ever try to organize one without a compact, Congress will say, that's a great idea, and why, we'll just organize it just like us. And now we get to get proposed amendments with just simple majorities. Woohoo! So keep in mind that the compact fills all of those voids. It fills all those voids, and because it sunsets in 7 years, it does in real time politically. It manifests real political will, an institution versus an institution, and thereby forces Congress to make a real political choice. They can either choose to oppose 38 states, or they can choose to go along with it. And there's no opportunity for Congress to circumvent it without denying the compact. So we think politically this is ultimately the best way to get through that bad-behaving Congress that we suspect will happen. So in the end, Mr. Chairman, representatives, members of this committee, we should heed the words of George Washington. The founders promised us that the states would have the ability to get whatever amendments they desired using Article 5. Logistically, it's been incredibly difficult. With the compact, it is finally plausible. It is finally available to us, and we can finally do the right thing for our kids and their kids, and that is fix the national debt. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very good testimony. And one more time, could you tell us your background before you went with the Goldwater Institute?
Certainly. I was at the Institute for Justice in Minnesota. Institute for Justice is a libertarian kind of economic liberty, free speech oriented a constitutional litigation firm for 3 years. Prior to that, I was in the city of Chicago, sadly, as an ordinary attorney, litigating for about 8 years. I had plenty of experience working in the Court of Appeals and the Illinois Supreme Court. But the bottom line is that was basically soul-killing work, and I am proudly now, for the past 8 years, been doing nothing but soul-enhancing work and in advancing constitutional law.
Okay. Any questions from the committee, Mr. Gentleman? And by the way, Senator Goldwater was a great photographer, I might point out. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We could call Don Brand to testify. Mr. Brand, are you here?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Could you make your presentation brief so we may take some kind of action on this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I will be very brief. My name is Don Brand. You may recall I volunteer with the Convention of States Project, and I do so because I want to do something that will address constraints on federal abuse, including spending. And in that regard, I will support any approach which has as its goal to seek amendments to constrain federal spending. Therefore, I support HB 284, and I urge you to move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Is this your personal testimony, or are you representing somebody, or what?
In this case, this is my personal testimony.
And that's sometimes the very best kind. Any questions for Mr. Brown? If not, anybody in the audience would like to testify on this bill? If not, I'll close public testimony. Any discussion around the table or comments? Representative Keller, Chair Keller.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have four committee members that are not on judiciary. We have three of us are in judiciary. And I just want to say that if you want to have committee discussion on this in state affairs, I am completely open to that. You know, but state it, because my choice, of course, would be to get this thing moved. You know, that's the natural tendency that I want. But I do not want to cut any of you out of this discussion on this bill. So, you can state that, and then we'll let the chair decide what he wants to do.
Good news.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A little louder, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I very much appreciate, and I am liking what I'm seeing. I would like to understand the actual budget amendment itself a little bit, and because we really talked more about the process and the need, the you know, the federal debt, but we didn't get into what the budget amendment itself would do, and I think it's important for us to understand that. And as much, and I know we are, there is a time constraint and we need to get this through, but it would be my preference to have a little more time to understand what that does, and so that's my preference.
Okay, any other? What would you guys?
Well, I guess I would say that I certainly understand where it fits into judiciary. I also understand that our federal budget we just cannot sustain, and I'm concerned that if we hold it longer and don't let it go through to the next committee, that we may not be able to pass it. So, in from that particular time constraint, I would be voting to move it out of committee and move it on to into judiciary, where I think that it's the place to be heard, the constitutional aspect of it. So that would be my vote.
Thank you. Reverend Christ Tompkins.
The Judiciary Committee seems like an appropriate venue for what is a supremely judicial bill.
Okay. Reverend Eisenhower, any comments before we vote?
No, Mr. Chair, I echo the majority sentiment. We have a lot of information, and I understand what Representative Hughes would like to do, but as expressed, I think the gist is that we are going to put some controls on it, and because of the judicial nature, the constitutional nature, I think they're going to be they'll safeguard our interest in making sure that it is doing what it's doing. I'm not a lawyer, so from what I've been looking at, I from what I comprehend, and there's a lot of documentation here, I'm all for it. You had me at Article 5. You know,
of course, yeah, there are only two lawyers on the Judiciary Committee.
True, but
thank heavens.
Yeah, thank heavens. So, but if it's the will of the committee, I'm prepared to make a motion to move it out of committee.
I was going to say, with permission of Ms. Representative Hughes, but she has something she wants to add.
Right, and if it were to go to the Judiciary Committee, could you address her concerns first up to bat?
And I was just going to say, I think that what I would like would only take a few minutes, actually. And I didn't know that we were, I thought we were going to spend a little more time on that, and that would be accomplished today. But I don't know if we could just look at that part of the bill, because I think that is the
let's see what we can do
core in just a few minutes to better understand, to look at that portion of the bill and make sure we all understand it. If we have
that time. If it's okay,
yeah,
have Nick come up and have Representative Hughes.
Then open public testimony again.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, members of the committee, Representative Hughes, I'm honored to answer any questions that you may have on this.
You can identify yourself again for her.
So let me, if I may,
identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry, Nicholas Dranius, on behalf of the Goldwater Institute and myself personally. I'm personally invested. Constitutional Policy Director.
Okay, Representative Hughes.
Yes, if you could just, I believe it begins on page 3, where it actually talks about the amendment first. If you could just kind of walk us through that, I think that we would have a better understanding of what this is all about at the core. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hughes. My pleasure. This is a historical effort.
Again, move the microphone closer.
My pleasure. It's a historical effort. It's critically important. So let me first emphasize that the proposed balanced budget amendment has 7 sections. The last of the 7 sections is the definitionals section. And I really have to, and this is section 7, and I want to just emphasize that the definitions section is probably the most important part of the entire amendment, because without fully understanding and grappling with those definitions, the rest of the sections cannot really be fully understood. So as I walk through each section,
I will be making reference to the definitional section as needed to make sure that everyone is aware that I'm not just supplying information, I'm pulling it from the definition section. So the first section, section one, is the definition of balance, in essence. Section one says that total outlays, meaning total expenditures, if you look at the definitions, total expenditures of the United States government, will be limited at all points in time, it says any point in time, at any point in time, to total receipts, defined as all tax receipts and other income, excluding, and this is really important, excluding the proceeds from debt or the incurrence of liability. Now, I'll explain what that caveat means really briefly, but the intention of this is to limit spending to only taxes and things like taxes. And that definition of total receipts is designed to accomplish the goal of preventing something like a trillion-dollar coin from being minted, stuck into the bank account, and then spent. The reason why that definition works in that fashion is anytime money is created out of thin air, that is proceeds from the incurrence of a liability. Going back to the days that money was backed by specie, gold and silver, the cash that you had in your pocket was viewed as a claim, as a liability from the perspective of the bank holding the gold. So we've defined out of the world of possibilities any effort to just print money, stick it in the bank account, and then spend it and stay under the spending limit.
Okay. Can you just touch on it? Because our vice chair has agreed to cover this in detail as the first thing up to bat if we move the bill out today. And we have somebody who will testify in this bill who is about ready to get on an airplane.
All right.
And in Juneau, that's Chancy.
I may be here for a couple of days. I don't.
You may be.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, then really quickly. So the first section is that crucial definition of limiting spending to what we have cash on hand and no gaming allowed. The second section is the establishment of the revolving line of credit. It's established at 105% of the outstanding debt on ratification. So if you had $20 trillion outstanding, the revolving line of credit would be pinned at $21 trillion. That extra $1 trillion would give us a current burn rate of about $600 billion, enough for a year, year and a half of additional borrowing to try to figure out what to do next. Okay? Section 3 is the referendum process, whereby if you wanted to increase that initial revolving line of credit, you would refer a measure out to the states and the majority of them would have to approve it. The significant thing about this provision is it deems void ab initio anything that would involve a quid pro quo. So the possibility of the states being coerced or literally bribed into approving debt increases is greatly minimized because it risks the soundness of the bond issuance. It could be deemed void ab initio, and that would spook bonding markets. So we think that would keep the referendum process clean and non-coercive, more like what we see with bonding referrals at the school district level. In Section 4, that's the impoundment section. This is where you have that requirement that roughly 6 months prior to hitting the debt limit, the parties put their cards on the table as to what they would have to impound if the debt limit is not increased or if taxes or spending is not cut or raised. Section 5 is the part that is the tax limit, and this is where you have a general rule of two-thirds required for any increase or new taxes with the three exceptions using simple majorities to either get to a fair tax, get to a flatter tax, or to rely on tariffs and fees. Again, this is viewed as a compromise. It's principled in nature. And
that's ahead.
And that's it. And the rest is definitions. And then, I'm sorry, Section 7, I misidentified the definition of Section 6. Section 7 is self-enforcement. It just says that you don't have to have a Congress pass a law to make this effective. As soon as it's ratified, boom, it's in place.
If I could, Mr. Chair. What I'd like to point out is one thing real quick is Nick will be an invitation gone out to all legislators that the speaker's chambers, he'll be there at 4 o'clock to answer questions. Plus he has made a commitment to me that he's gonna be there, you know, for you, and I'm sure we can arrange, you know, a time with you specifically. But you know, he will be coming back up, and he's a resource for us in this process. And with that, I'd like to make a motion to move the bill.
I just want to say I thank you. I think it was important to get on the public record. I know it was up on the slide a little bit, but I think it was important to make sure we all understand that. So I appreciate that luxury of the extra few minutes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. Great testimony. Public testimony closed. Judge Isaacson, do you have any comment or motion?
No, if it's the will of the body, I'll move that we move House Bill number 284, version 28-LS1223/N, or /N, with all amendments and attached fiscal notes.
Thank you. Any objection?
Individual recommendation.
And individual
recommendation.
Okay. With no objection, the bill passed. Thank you very much, everybody, for your testimony. And we have a sponsor. The next bill come up, please. That would be HB 199.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Bryce Edgman. I represent.
Again, closer to the mic, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I think I'm projecting them now. For the record, my name is Bryce Edgman. I represent House District 36, and I'm the prime sponsor of House Bill 199. Did you desire me any...
Well, I think most everybody knows what the bill is about. I did have one question. Has there ever been a VPSO injured or killed in the line of duty as a VPSO? And if so, where did that happen and how did it happen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unfortunately, the answer is yes. And there were two incidents of fatalities. Both were in Bristol Bay. The first was October 22nd of 1986 in the community of South Naknek. Ronnie Zimmern lost his life pursuing a domestic incidents of domestic violence. The second incident was last year, March 19th, 2013, in Manicotick, which is 16 air miles away from Dillingham. That
how many miles away?
16.
Okay.
I think the larger answer might be as well is that overall there's just been an increasing number of assaults against VPSOs as there has been against state troopers and others in the law enforcement community. And it's my sense, very unfortunately so, that things have changed in rural Alaska in many communities. The environment is more dangerous. There's more episodes of domestic violence, of drug-related altercations, and all of the above. And it would just be a matter of time before there might be another violent confrontation that hopefully this bill would help avoid in the future.
I know it's impossible to answer, but if those VPOs had been armed, might have the result been different?
Mr. Chairman, of course, we'll never know for sure. And I can only answer sort of anecdotally, and I should be careful what I put on the record, but I can tell you, in terms of the Manicotick incidents, just talking to a lot of local residents, they felt that it would have made a difference. And that's probably the best answer I could put forward.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to call Carla up here. Carla Asnacock, are you online or in the room? From the Bristol Bay Native Association?
Hi, this is Carla
Asnacock. Just a moment, we can hardly hear you. Can you turn the volume up back there or pull the mic closer to where you are testifying from?
Okay.
Much better.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, very, very good. Please identify yourself and present your testimony. I try to keep it as brief as possible because, if possible, we might want to try to move the bill, or not move the bill, but at least take action on it. Please continue. Identify yourself.
Okay, I identify myself. My name is Carla Acklecock, C-A-R-L-A. Last name is Acklecock, A-K-E-L-K-O-K. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Lynn, before I start my testimony, we'd like to thank Representative Bryce Edgman for all he's done with House Bill 199. I am the VPSO Program Manager for the Bristol Bay Native Association. We'd like to thank you for the opportunity to hear our input on House Bill 199 of arming VPSOs. On behalf of VBNA Board of Directors and our President CEO Ralph Anderson, we're in favor of the bill. VBNA is a regional Alaskan Native nonprofit corporation and tribal consortium which has operated the VPSO program since its inception for more than 30 years. Both of the VPSA statewide who have died in the line of duty were BBNA employees, Ron Zimmerman in South Market in 1986 and Thomas Medola in Manicotti. March 19, 2013, both are honored and in our hearts and memories. BBNA strongly supports changing state policy to allow VPSOs to be honored with the required certified training. We think this should be a local policy decision for the particular community and nonprofit employer. At present, our VPSO contract with the Department of Public Safety prohibits us from allowing the VPSOs to be honored while on duty. Shortly after the death of VPSO Medola, the BBNA Board of Directors adopted Resolution 2013-07, which called on the Alaska Department of Public Safety to rescind the ban on honoring VPSOs. In September 2013, the BBNA Board adopted Resolution 2013-14 expressing support in House Bill 199. We also believe the social environment in rural Alaska has changed in the last 30 years and that increased use of alcohol and drugs such as methamphetamine and heroin makes the VPSO's jobs more hazardous. We support changing state policy to allow VPSOs to be honored. We recognize this should be done through a planned process and that appropriate training be provided. If approved, BBNA has volunteered to be a part of the pilot project with the Department of Public Safety. Again, we thank you for hearing our testimony.
Well, thank you very much. Anytime anybody uses a firearm, me or anybody at the table here, or a police officer, or potentially a VPSO, there's possibility of liability falling on someone. Does your association have any concerns about that?
We do. I'm sure we're looking at, working with the Department of Public Safety and other nonprofits, we formed a armed working group to do some more research and...
Okay, and I'm going to ask everybody from the villages that same question. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is Jordy Potts there, here, or somewhere? Jody Potts?
Yes, this is Jody Potts.
Thank you. Please identify yourself and give your testimony.
Okay, my name is Jody Potts, J-O-D-Y-P-O-T-T-S. I'm the VPSO coordinator for TAN Chiefs Conference, and I'm also a sergeant VPSO, having served over 4 years as a VPSO. Chairman, I want to thank the state and commend the state for bringing forth this bill. Particularly, I'd like to thank Representative Edgman for bringing this forward to support the VPSOs and the important work that they do in rural Alaska. Having been a VPSO for over 4 years, working on the ground and in the field, there definitely has been a increase in violence and the level of violence and unpredictability of the people we are dealing with on a regular basis, along with an increase in assaults on officers. And for the safety of our officers and the communities, we feel it's really important to have VPSOs be armed. In the Chiefs Conference Executive Board and President supports Army VPSOs, and we have full faith in the Department of Public Safety to properly train VPSOs, having been a part of the meetings and discussions already with the Department of Public Safety, having been a recruit at the Academy, knowing the level of training and the Academy environment in Sitka. I believe that the training will be sufficient, and the only concerns that we have is the screening process. Currently, VPSOs have to pass a very basic criminal background check, and then the nonprofit is allowed to interview them and hire them. State troopers and other municipal police in the state who are certified through the Alaska Police Standards Council do have to go through much more lengthy screening process to include a more in-depth background check, psyche valves, polygraphs, physical fitness tests, more lengthy interviews. So the process is much greater, and I feel like that's very important as we want to make sure that our communities are getting highly qualified individuals that are fit mentally and physically in order to carry a firearm. And I believe, based on the research that I've done, that this is very important also in liability cases, should there ever be an excessive use force case that comes up against the VPSO, their agency, and possibly the state. And from all the casework that I've read, they often look at the screening process the agency requires, and currently I don't believe that the state would make this across the board where everyone, all VPSOs hired, they may leave it up to each individual nonprofit on what kind of screening process, and I feel like it would be a disservice to all Alaskans if the state does not require at least a psyche eval for mental fitness and a physical fitness test added to the current requirement of a criminal background check.
We know that, I believe that this bill contemplates less training than it would be for uniformed officer, police, or trooper, or so on. Does that concern you?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the part of your question.
Well, there are certain levels of training for use of deadly force, particularly firearms. The fact that this bill would permit fewer hours of training for using a firearm than a trooper or a cop someplace in the state, does that concern you?
Yes, I believe that the villages that we're serving deserve the highest quality of trained professionals to serve their people and protect their people. I don't see why a rural community deserves anything less than any other officers in a lower standard. I do believe in the high level and quality of training that the DPS Academy provides, and I believe that VPSOs and the communities they serve deserve a equally high level that all the other officers in the state obtains.
Doug, are you concerned about any potential liability to the corporation at any particular level of training?
Yes, I am. The concern I have is if the state does not make it mandatory for all VPSOs, no matter what region and nonprofit they serve, if they don't have a more stringent screening process. And through my research in all excessive use cases, they don't only look at the situation at the time of the incident, but they also look at the officer, their training level, they look at their background and their the screening process, pre-hire screening processes. And should there not be a psyche eval done to determine the mental fitness of the officer or physical fitness or any other more stringent screening processes to determine whether or not this person should be an armed officer, I think would really cause more liability, and I feel like we would potentially lose excessive use force, excessive force cases.
Do you support this bill as is, or do you not support it as is?
Well, I generally support it, and Tim, the chief, supports it, but we also really strongly feel that across the board they really need to address the screening process to make sure that there are individuals that are hired that will be armed. And I fully trust the training level will be there. I just don't, I'm not sure that it's been addressed or not, whether they would be screened properly.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
I've been Reverend News.
Yes, Mr. Chair, at the appropriate time, if the bill sponsor would be able to address those two factors about the screening and why that wasn't included, and also as far as the training that she brought up, I would appreciate it.
Yeah. introduce yourself again, please? And before you start, is Joy Hinkins still here in the room?
No, she had to
leave. Is she not? Okay, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, once again, Bryce Edgemond, Representative for House District 36. I think the witness brings up some excellent points, and I think it's consistent with the testimony that we've been hearing in the previous committee here in the House, as well as the committee discussion that was in the Senate CNRA just yesterday. And I think those points aren't lost on me as the bill sponsor. They're certainly not lost on the department staff who are here in the room. They've been tracking this bill, been advocating for the bill. And yesterday I had the opportunity to talk with the CEO of the BBNA, Regional Native Not-for-Profit Association. He talks with his peers very regularly. This has been a big item of discussion. And get the mic adjusted here. I've been assured time and again by the department that the screening process, the training process, everything that goes into equipping a VPSO with arms, as you've seen the fiscal note, right now it's proposed very as a limited number, 20 or so VPSOs that actually come forward, but that the whole process itself is going to be thorough. It's going to be under the umbrella of the Alaska Police Standards Council requirements. I have been assured that the training that would be given to a VPSO would be similar, if not directly on par with what a municipal police officer would get. And I would suspect, I can't speak for the regional not-for-profit associations or certainly the communities themselves, but those VPSOs that would go forward are going to be very carefully vetted. And Mr. Chairman, I would end with my personal commitment to this requirement. I'm now making plans, hopefully, if time allows, to actually go down to the training academy and sit down on a Saturday. I've been told by the department that there will be active training going on in a couple of weeks, and I would invite anybody else who wants to take the trip down to Sitka for the day, as I understand, you get in and out and actually see up close what would all be entailed in terms of training and evaluating a prospective VPSO officer who might be able to carry arms.
That'd be very good. It'd be sure they're getting back from Sitka. Representative Gaddis?
Thank you, and thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think it is time, and I certainly plan on supporting it. Here are one of my concerns, and I'm certainly not going to hold the bill up, and I think Representative Edgemond, I think that you've certainly alluded to this when you talk about the training, but I think that there's a special training that happens in small communities when people are related or they're interrelated, when they have to be the policeman, for lack of a better word. I think that the training that I think is real important is how to diffuse and how to work those situations that I think are even more important in a smaller community than they are in large municipal communities that you're not related. God forbid that you would have to go to your own family and have to deal with this. So I think that the training is very, very important, and I'm not entirely sure it's the same training that larger municipalities participate with. But potentially an additional piece that helps you kind of process through in small towns and in certainly in small families, if you will. Because I think we all know that once you bring a weapon into the situation, it certainly escalates the situation. That being said, I don't think that our folks in the villages should be without a weapon.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. So, as the bill's sponsor, and from the testimony we've heard so far, it is your intention that the phrase minimum standards and training is associated with the Alaska Police Standards Council for this subject, as far as ongoing training requirements and psych evals and such for carrying and deploying this a firearm.
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, we actually double-checked that. At the conclusion of the Community Regional Affairs hearing, a week or so ago, I asked the department staff if they could actually talk to the Department of Law once again to make sure that that, in fact, was the case, and the answer I got back was yes.
Okay, so no amendment is needed to make sure that that intent is fulfilled in regulation.
That's correct.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. Is Albert Judson online or in the room? Please come forward, sir. Thank you for being here.
My name is Robert Judson. I'm from Clicker Tribe. I'm also a former VPSA. My father was the very first policeman in Hona. He worked unarmed. And later on, I was sworn in as a deputy patrolman under my uncle. I was 21 years old. I worked unarmed as a patrolman. And later on, I became a VPSO. And I left later on. I was burned out. I was working at two jobs. And I should have taken medical leave, but I was burned out and I quit. But I'm very much in support of House Bill 199 and Senate Bill 98. Simply because of the work that I did, the experiences I've had, and the things I've seen. The very first hour I was on duty, my boss was attacked by a guy with a switchblade. And the very first week that I was on duty, my very first assignment was this man that had shell shock. He was going to kill everyone and kill himself. And he had no one. And I was forced to fight him to get the airman away from him. That was after my first week on duty. And so I was speaking from the experiences I've had, the things I've seen, the training I've had. I gained a hip pocket knowledge of law from my uncle. He was chief of police, former United States Army instructor. And I have some questions on this hospital living room in favor of it. One of the questions I have is, does it any man have the right to protect himself under the United States Constitution? Does any man under the United States Constitution have the right to bear arms? And I would like to see the VPSOs armed. I would like to see them get temporary permits immediately, even before they get training. My rationale is very simple. Once you're on the job, you're on the job. There is no turning back. There are no second chances. You can't call a SWAT team to help you out. And many times there's no one there to help. Temporary permits should be issued immediately, even before VPSOs go for trainings. It's for their own protection, and also for the role that they play, because they protect the general public, and their role is that they protect people without regard to race, color, creed, or whatever, and they take an oath of office to protect the United States Constitution and the state constitution. And that oath should be taken seriously. And I had another question. Wasn't there a law that that if a policeman or law enforcement was attacked, that if a citizen failed to help protect them, that they would be violating the law. Shouldn't that law apply to APSOs? Shouldn't that law apply to anyone in law enforcement, dispatchers and jailers? Shouldn't that law be honored not only by troopers and by department, but by the village and by the city, no matter where they are? Because when you take a look at the way the United States was formed and the things the United States has fought for freedom, the right to be free and safe in your own home, to be secure, shouldn't that apply to everyone? Not just non-natives, but also native people. And I was thinking about state troopers and their relationship to VPSOs also. And I had a question for the committee that I don't know if you would agree with it or not. Should there be a separate state trooper academy separate from the VPSO? Should there be a public safety academy for public safety officers and VPSOs as well as security personnel? My rationale is very simple. I've talked to security, many of them are unqualified. Many of them are former veterans, but they've never had training in security. And if there was a public safety academy for VPSOs and security personnel, that would alleviate that weakness. Other than that, I am in favor of House Bill 199 and Senate Bill 98. The only part where I'm not too sure about is under where it says who otherwise meet minimum standards of training. That's where I feel like that temporary permits should be issued immediately, if not sooner, simply because of the state that the VPSOs are in and the job that they have to do.
Yeah, we're going to have to. I want to thank you for your testimony, and I want to thank you for your service as a VPSO. Okay. Thank you again for your. I would like to move this bill today, or not move it today, but we are out of time. We lost about, 20, 30 minutes because of the communication problem, so we can't really have a proper discussion to move or not to move the bill, I don't think, in the time we have. So I want to thank those who testified, and we'll try to put this number one up on the very next meeting that we have. The schedule for the next House State Affairs Committee had not yet been finalized, but we are probably going to have it very first on the agenda, and I hope to take action on it. I want to apologize to Chief Kim I, Mike Kuhn, and Jake Medcalf, who've been waiting very patiently to testify. But again, thank you so much. We are adjourned.